Blog Talk Radio.
Everyone, and welcome to Blog Talk Radio and the Cosmic Citizen. I'm here broadcasting from beautiful British Columbia at the home of Gary Tong and Lisa Tao and their beautiful children, River and Kai. So if you hear some background noise, that's what you're hearing, my friends, and I can't put it on mute because I have to speak. So, but that's fine. That's live radio. as my old friend
radio.
Andre Traversa used to say, that's live radio, friends. And, of course, we're here with our dear friends, Andre Rodatis and Chuck Thurston. Hi, you guys.
Hey,
good morning.
Good morning. And Marvin will be popping in. He's going to be listening for a while. He said he's on the road, and then when he gets home, he's going to come in. So the four of us will be here, and that will be fun. And we are continuing our study of paper 36, The Life Carriers. And I was reviewing it a bit, you guys, before we came on, and I noticed that we are in number 3, life transplantation. We did read about the 7 spheres, but we can reprise that or we can discuss it some more if you think we should. That's fine. But,
when do we
There's
know?
A lot in there.
Huh? What, Andre?
when do we not reprise anything?
Well, that's true. That's true.
Yeah.
So,
very nice to be with everybody.
Yeah. It's good. It's been kind of a crazy summer for me. I wouldn't have thought, you know, when I retired from the fellowship, I would have thought that it wouldn't have been so crazy because summers at the fellowship are always crazy. You know, it's a conference, and Chuck knows the drill now because he's been with Derek through the summer. It gets really busy in the summer, and I would have thought that summers would have slowed down a little bit, but that's not the case. But I'm so glad to be here in British Columbia with Gary and so many great things happening in the Urantia movement right now. Wonderful projects. It just thrills me that all of this great stuff is happening. And it's, you know, it's just organically bubbling up, like the Jesus Metaverse and Urantia University. There's just really wonderful projects happening. It thrills me to see it happen. We've come a long way. You know, we've come a very long way. And
all of these things are still in the beginning, you know?
Right, right.
Well, we all keep learning too.
Right. Yeah,
that's
Derek's doing that.
Go
ahead, Chuck. Sorry.
Oh, something I was kind of reflecting on this morning, especially after relocating to Boulder, you know, back in 2020.
Mm-hmm.
You know, participating in several Zoom study groups on a regular basis. I don't know. I just feel like I'm just continuing to become more familiar with the book, which is a good feeling. I like that.
It is a good feeling.
I mean,
me too.
There's so many details that come out, like Nambia, for example.
There you go.
I forgot all about Nambia.
Head honcho of the life carriers. You bet.
Yeah.
Nambia, head honcho.
Well, and then the work that Derek and I put into our study group podcast, too.
Which, again, I was going to say, Your Ranch Book Network, which is a project that Derek has spearheaded and just so faithfully championed that project. He has a vision of it. He can see it. He sees that it's, you know, and I know his dream is that it will be a network that we can all use, that no one will ever be able to tell us, no, you can't say that. You know, you can't talk about that on this network, you know,
well,
so that we can have our studies.
Yeah, the app is pretty functional now. I mean, you know,
the
bugs keep getting worked out, but it's, you know, it's available, it's free, and it's definitely.
Yeah, you can find it on the App Store, the Ranch Book Network. Be sure and download that, friends, because I think it's just extraordinary what all it can do and the way it just allows for spontaneous sharing and study with across the network. You know, and anybody in the world can be on it at any time. Really, really wonderful work that Derek's done there. So proud of him.
Yeah, it's kind of
you know,
a vision. Mm-hmm.
It is a vision, yeah. He's been able to articulate it, at least to me, very clearly, what he sees, you know, and bring it to life. He spearheaded that whole thing, and he, you know, dealt with the developers and so that's another really wonderful project that's happening.
Mm-hmm.
Our dear friend Pam is on the board. She's spearheaded working with the emergent Christians, and that
emergent
has been
Christians,
such an important.
Yeah.
Wow. You know, maybe we're gaining some traction here, and that makes me happy because I've kind of learned over the years that it's just slow going. Even when you're trying as hard as you can, it's like rolling a boulder up a hill, and it's not going to go too fast. Mo and I had a good chuckle one day because we've spent most of our work life together. We've worked for years together doing Your Ranch Outreach, and we laughed about the slow growth policy that that the movement had for years. You know, it was like this. And I think it's because they came out of secrecy, right? They, you know, they were told they couldn't tell anybody and whatnot. And so that kind of was a hangover that the whole Urantia movement had. And we had a good chuckle about slow growth being a policy because it goes without saying with the Urantia book. You don't have to worry about going slow with it. It's built in.
It's sort of built in.
Yeah, it's built in, you know. It's only going to call the few the brave at first because of its, you know, just because of its size and the density of the material in it. But once you start to study it, as we were saying earlier, what a gift it becomes.
Well,
you know, it's like Chris Howerson says, you start to unpack it.
Yeah, yeah, the more familiar, at least that's what I've noticed, that I become with the Urantia book, the more new stuff. I mean, the more, you know, when I go back and even reread something I've read a dozen times, you know, I'll see it in a new way or something will come out, some new meaning, some new relevance, or even maybe a new value will kind of emerge. I don't know. It's a funny thing about the Urantia book. It's like it's got so much depth to it. Like so many levels of comprehension and correlation and combination of concepts. And now with search engines, that's such a gift that we can cross-correlate and do searches. and just, you know, instantly get a whole bunch of dimensions of meaning that wouldn't necessarily be obvious just from a straight reading. You see all the different references to something. I only found one reference in
that,
to Nambia, though.
Yeah, there's only one Nambia. Right. What a great word that is, too. It's kind of a fun one, fun name. But what you just said, Chuck, reminded me of something that Jesus said, and it's from paper 178, section 1, paragraph 15. He says, "This gospel of the kingdom is a living truth. I have told you it is like the leaven in the dough, like the grain of mustard seed. And now I declare it is like the seed of the living being, which from generation to generation, while it remains the same living seed, unfailingly unfolds itself in new manifestations and grows acceptably in channels of new adaptation to the peculiar needs and conditions of each successive generation. The revelation I have made to you is a living revelation, and I desire that it shall be appropriate, that it shall bear appropriate fruits in each individual and in each generation in accordance with the laws of spiritual growth, increase, and adaptative development. From generation to generation, this gospel must show increasing vitality and exhibit greater depth of spiritual power. It must not be permitted to become merely a sacred memory, a mere tradition about me and the times in which we now live." I was reading one day, and that statement of his just dawned. It just struck me that this Urantia book is like that. It's like that. It's a living revelation. And that's why when we're reading it, we have that experience of like, is that in there? I don't remember seeing that before. But it lives in us, and it expands, and it adapts because of what it is. It is a living seed. I am convinced that this revelation is like just what he described himself being.
Yeah.
It is an ethical revelation. It's a living revelation. And, of course,
it's open.
You know, his...
I was going to say it's open-ended.
It's what?
Open-ended.
Yeah.
Open-ended. It doesn't take you somewhere and close the door, you know, like a dog, dogma would do. It's an invitation to explore and discover on our own and then get together
and
talk
about it.
And go deeper
in. Yeah. Right. So, yeah, that statement reminds me of the Urantia book, the statement he made about the living truth that he was providing, the fourth epical revelation. This revelation is like that as well. Yeah. That's thrilling.
Mm-hmm.
So, yay. Oh, well, you know, what did our old friend Steve McIntosh used to say? Spontaneous book fetishism. He would call it an outbreak of book fetishism where we just gush about how much we love this revelation. But
it's a little different.
Well, there's some truth to that. Yeah.
In a good way.
Yeah, in a good way. In a very good way.
Yeah.
I guess you could call it a fetish. I don't know. It's...
Well, the funny thing about it is, you know, nobody takes the Urantia book as being infallible either. You know, very often, you know, so they say, what do they mean by that? Oh, that's, you know, that can't be true or whatever. You know, there's a lot of provocative statements. And even, who knows, you know, it's not about it becoming a sacred fetish in the sense that you can't question it. That's kind of one of the things I enjoy about Urantia book study is that people do question it, you know, trying to understand it, or maybe there is actually here and there some things that don't quite add up. But for the most part, it does all cross-correlate and coordinate and fit together just unbelievably for something so complex. But it takes a lot of questioning to really get into the depths of it, and I like that about it. You know, the people aren't afraid to, you know. And many, many places, the authors themselves say, well, we don't really know. You know, we'll give you our best guess, but we don't really know. And I always, I like that kind of tickles my spirit, you know, to hear these high beings themselves even saying that they don't really know about a lot of things.
I love that. That makes it authentic to me, you know.
The thing
that came through loud and clear for me was their love for us.
Uh-huh.
From the moment I picked it up, I felt their love for us. And I've always been able, even as a child, able to feel angels. I never felt alone in my life. I always felt the unseen listener, you know. And I always had wonderful conversations with God and angels. And, you know, not that I heard them talk back, but I just could feel their love. And I felt that so keenly in me, Rachel. It's like, wow, this is them. This is them.
Yeah, they're talking
to
me.
This is how they feel. Yeah, they're talking to us. I feel them. It's how they feel. You know, their love comes through everything they do. Everything they do is motivated by love. It's motivated by what's best for us. Like a true parent, like a loving parent, does what they do. What's best for their child. That's the love I feel coming through in spades in the intangible. And really amazing stuff.
Indeed.
So, I know we're all in agreement about how wonderful the intangible book is. It's just, what can you say? But we did the Life Carrier Worlds last time, and I remember making a comment. These are their labs, right? And, you know, they spell out each different world and how functional, how it functions and what it does and how the life carriers use it. Did you want to recover that, or do you want to move on to number three, life
transplantation? Well, how about if we maybe just read the last three paragraphs?
That's
starting
a good idea.
World number five. Well, number five is, I mean, it's all interesting, but maybe those last three will send us off into section three.
Okay. You want to do that, Chuck, and then you can go on with three if you want, or we'll stop and talk, and then you can go on with three, too.
Stop and chat for a second, but number five, I think, is interesting in terms of what it says about mind, and six, too. Anyway, so this is... Paper 36, Section 2, starting with paragraph 18. Number five world is concerned wholly with life associated with mind. Each of its satellites is devoted to the study of a single phase of creature mind correlated with creature life. Mind, such as man comprehends, is an endowment of the seven adjutant mind spirits, superimposed on the non-teachable or mechanical levels of mind by the agencies of the infinite spirit, you know, working through the mother spirit. The life patterns are variously responsive to these adjutants and to the different spirit ministries operating throughout the universes of time and space. The capacity of material creatures to affect spirit response is entirely dependent on the associated mind endowment, which in turn has directionized the course of the biologic evolution of these same mortal creatures. World number six is dedicated to the correlation of mind with spirit as they are associated with living forms and organisms. This world and its six tributaries embrace the schools of creature coordination, wherein teachers from both the central universe and the super universe collaborate with the Nebadon instructors in presenting the highest levels of creature attainment in time and space. The seventh sphere of the life carriers is dedicated to the unrevealed domains of evolutionary creature life, as it is related to cosmic philosophy, to the cosmic philosophy of the expanding factualization of the Supreme Being. There's a couple things in there that kind of got my attention. you know, this idea that the life patterns are variously responsive to the adjutants, I think is interesting. You know, so it's like the adjutants are there, but depending on the life pattern of the organism, that organism will get what it needs, what it has capacity to receive, even though maybe the adjutants have much more to offer than what anyone can really pick up on at any one time. It somehow becomes customized to the individual receptivity.
In this instance, what do you think they mean by life patterns?
You know, one of the possibilities that's been coming up lately has to do with the difference between male and female, for example.
Good one.
So, you know, as a male, I pick up on the male version of the adjutant spirits, and as a female, you pick up on the female version in some sense. I mean, in other words, that our physical organism and our life pattern is matched to the mind ministry that we receive.
Wow. That's a good one. I wonder if male or female might be more responsive to different adjutants, you know? Certain adjutants might be more keyed into females and certain ones might be more.
Or even any given adjutant. Even a given adjutant might have a wide range of applicability.
Right.
Depending on the organism. I mean, it's the same adjutant.
Wow.
That are ministering to other, you know, even non-breathers, I would presume, or many other types of mortal types. So there's that. And then there's the animals, of course, and they're different from us, you know, and they have higher mammals have 5 adjutants.
Right, right.
So there's a lot of...
And you can clearly see some of the more intelligent animals, the spirits are much more responsive in them. The higher mammals, the more intelligent mammals. Yeah.
But it's always in the way of that animal. You know, it's like looking at chimpanzees lately. And they have a particular kind of mindedness, the same adjutants, but they receive them in a way that's peculiar or special to their particular nature as a creature
as
a life form.
That makes total sense to me.
Yeah,
you know,
and there's something similar to that may be going on with gender as well. So,
right, and then I think of one brain, two brain, and three brain. You know, they would be responsive differently in those beings, and you know,
pituitary bodies they talk about. Also,
yeah, and non-breather,
creating variability
and spirit
response.
Right. Interesting.
I'm wondering what you guys think of this last sentence, though. Well, they say that the capacity of material creatures to affect spirit response is entirely dependent on the associated mind endowment. And that's kind of this, and they elsewhere they say that our mind endowment is entirely dependent on our physical organism to a large extent. But then they say, which in turn has directionized the course of biologic evolution of these same mortal creatures. So that's a level of adjutant mind function that, you know, we think about our own consciousness, right, and associate that with adjutant mind receptivity. But here they're talking about the adjutant spirits actually directionizing the course of biologic evolution, which is kind of a whole different level of function, I think. And that's intriguing because it kind of speaks to the process of evolutionary emergence of life forms and all of that. That somehow the adjutant spirits have had a role to play.
Yeah, I'm
the
trying
evolution.
To mute the children because or mute my phone because Isadora pointed it out that it's somewhat distracting, and so I just want you to know I'm listening intently, but I'm on mute. So Andre, you know, just keep be mindful of that if you keep the conversation live.
I'm being mindful, and I'm mindful of my own distractions here. You have children noises. I have canine children here that I'm
dog-sitting.
Oh, you have canine children there. Yeah. It sounds like Chuck's the only one who's in his normal environment, but yeah.
Yeah, right, more or less.
So,
yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, thanks, Isadora, for letting me know, because I was a little concerned about that. And, yeah. So I'll try to keep on mute unless we're actually, you know, conversing. But
yeah.
So
anyway,
did you?
I was just wondering what you guys think of that last sentence about how the adjuvants directionize the course of biologic evolution, and if that maybe is still going on to some extent. I mean, we've kind of reached, I guess,
I think you're right.
Well,
the adjuvants are. They're part of the evolution is the way to think of it. It's not like the life carriers, which are actually doing in the pre-will phases, are doing some kind of actual directionization and trying to direct various life forms into particular environments so that they might have greater possibility of evolving in a certain way. Once
mm-hmm.
will appears, they have to retreat from that. They take interference renunciation vows and are translated to a more spiritual phase so that they can't physically interfere anymore. And they're pretty much done with what they can do directly. You know, they still indirectly survey and make proposals to their superiors or whatever, but they're now pretty much out of it. But they indicate that the adjuvant mind spirits are an intrinsic part of the evolution. It evolve with life. And not only on one world, but throughout the entire local universe. And it's been a source of endless fascination. Yeah, it's been a source of endless fascination to me, the idea that on most normal worlds, and especially, you know, most of the worlds of the local universe as they are constituted and not under rebellion kinds of conditions, you know, or the aftermath of rebellion, and not radical adjustment worlds or otherwise, you know, worlds that are decimal planets like ours, they tend to all interplay, and that life evolution and that adjuvant evolution all contributes to the way the adjuvants function on all of those other worlds. In other words, they are communicating more with those other worlds, whereas on Urantia, they've been relatively isolated. They don't have the opportunity to interact with the adjuvant mind spirits as they function on these other worlds. It's kind of an interesting way of trying to think about this, the way they talk about it. I'm not sure that we can fully grasp exactly how it's functioning, but it is interesting because they indicate that we don't have that interplay with evolution on the other worlds. We're having a pretty isolated development of how the adjuvants are interacting with our minds here.
Well, especially being a decimal planet.
That is really intriguing to me. I was just going to throw out a question too and finish your thought, but I just want to throw this out. Do you think that's what they do a lot of times on an experimental life world like ours, is they try to up that responsiveness to the life or to the adjuvant mind spirits and make them more responsive on a life experimentation plant like ours?
Right, maybe reaching more into the potentials.
Yeah, right.
I think there's that. I think there's also when they're talking about, you know, life interacting with mind and mind with spirit, and then the Supreme, they're always looking at how do we make this life such that it evolves so that it is more responsive to mind with spirit, and how do we get it to evolve in such a way that it's somehow more responsive even to the Supreme Being eventually. Now, it's not like they have gotten really very far with that, but they make some very curious statements about trying to discover the presence of the Supreme, these celestial artisans that they call the compound builders or something like that, in paper 44, that they say, in effect, this combination of spirit, mind, and matter that they're trying to do is really an attempt to discover the Supreme, which is a fascinating statement. I'll pull up the quote just to be able to refer to that, but it's kind of fascinating that they would actually make that kind of statement. Okay, so the compound manipulators is what they are, and this is paper 44, section 5, paragraph 5, subsection 4 of that section. Compound manipulators. This is the adventurous group of well-trained beings who are dedicated to the functional association of the three original phases of divine energy manifested throughout the universes as physical, mindful, and spiritual energies. These are the keen personalities who are in reality seeking to discover the universe presence of God the Supreme. For in this deity personality, there must occur the experiential unification of all grand universe divinity. And to a certain extent, the artisans have in recent times met with some success. That's fascinating. So when they're talking about, you know, in subsection 7 on the seventh world that we've just read, they're not speaking idly here about their study, some kind of navel gazing or anything like that. They have a method to their miraculousness, let's say it that way. I won't say madness. And when they say the life carriers are dedicated to the unrevealed domains of evolutionary creature life as it is related to the cosmic philosophy of the expanding factualization of the Supreme Being, what they mean is, as the Supreme Being becomes more discoverable, as the Supreme Being becomes more real to the grand universe, it has a decided effect, and it becomes a factor in what life can do and how life can respond to yet another reality in the universe. In the same way that we have life that can relate to adjutant mind spirits, to the Holy Spirit, to the cosmic mind, you know, at higher levels, and not to mention spirit influences, the spirit of truth, the functioning of the eternal sun spirit, all of those kinds of things. With all of those things, all of those realities interacting, here is yet another one that's evolving, and we know that the Supreme Being eventually is going to enable these universes to be functioning in perfection, the whole grand universe. Well, how does that happen? There must be an entire science and spirituality and philosophy of living on how that all works together. And this is what's fascinating again about the revelation, is disparate parts of the revelation all tie in or can illuminate parts of the revelation.
Indeed.
That's so
good.
Amazing. Thank you, Andre. That was beautiful.
Yes, indeed. There are a couple of paragraphs in paper 42 that kind of also address the creative influence of the adjutants in the creature form, you might say. And I could just read these really quick because I think they're relevant to what you were just saying, Andre, and to also to what we just read. This is in paper 42, Energy, Mind, and Matter, in section 12. I'm just going to read the 9th paragraph and the 11th paragraph because they're both kind of about this. In the 9th paragraph, they say, mind is always creative. The mind endowment of an individual animal, mortal, Maranchan, spirit ascender, or finality attainer is always competent to produce a suitable and serviceable body for the living creature identity. And what this reminds me, you know, the book in many places talks about how reality flows from spirit to mind to matter. The value level is the determining level, and then the mind puts that into creative action, you know, the god of action, the third source and center, and then finally that has repercussions on the level of physical manifestation. So this is kind of saying that in a way about how mind influences our body. And, you know, I just never thought of it that way. I mean, before finding the Arantxa book, because we're so conditioned to think of reality going the other way, right? Where the physical level is the determining level. And then, well, maybe we'll discover mind and spirit. But here, that second sentence, let's read that again. The mind endowment of an individual animal, mortal, Maranchan, spirit ascender, or finality attainer. And this would include the whole, you know, thing with the Supreme as well, is always competent to produce a suitable and serviceable body for the living creature identity. But the present phenomenon of a personality or the pattern of an identity as such is not a manifestation of energy, either physical, mindful, or spiritual. The personality form is the pattern aspect of a living being, connotes the arrangement of energies, and this, plus life and motion, is the mechanism of creature existence. And just going to hold that. And down in paragraph 11, they say, the liaison of the cosmic mind and the ministry of the adjutant mind spirits evolve a suitable physical tabernacle for the evolving human being. Likewise, does the Maranchan mind individualize the Maranchan form for all mortal survivors? And the mortal body is personal and characteristic for every human being. As the mortal body is personal and characteristic for every human being, so will the Maranchan form be highly individual and adequately characteristic of the creative mind which dominates it. No two Maranchan forms are any more alike than any two human bodies. The Maranchan power supervisors, sponsor, and the attending seraphim provide the undifferentiated Maranchan material wherewith the Maranchan life can begin to work. And after the Maranchan life, it will be found that spirit forms are equally diverse, personal, and characteristic of their respective spirit mind indwellers. So kind of what I'm getting from that is that we're experiencing that to some extent even now. You know, our bodies are all different, like they're saying. And it's our instrument for personal expression, but for each of us, there's a uniqueness there. But yet it's ministered to and supported by the mind endowments that we're able to receive. So
yeah,
that whole idea of being individual and characteristic for each unique individual.
Those are two really
just mind. It's personality gets involved there too. In that earlier paragraph, we speak to that. So, anyway, you know, what we were just reading, I think they're talking about more of an evolutionary perspective, how the mind spirits influence the course of evolution. But then there's also just an individual, each of us as individuals also are receptive and conditioned by these same processes of
I think there are some metaphors. First of all, it's nice
Marvin's
to join you guys.
Marvin's joined us.
Yeah.
All right. Welcome.
Able to
participate. Hi, Marvin.
Hi, Paul. Hi, Chuck. Hi, Andre. Yeah, I'm just parked not far from home, but just want to share a thought, and then I'll drive home and then be able to participate fully. My tendency is always to look for metaphors in our human experience that help me grab on to some of what you guys are alluding to in the passages you're reading. And by the way, Chuck, what was that last one you were reading about the forms being responsive? And what was the citation on that passage?
That's in paper 42 in section 12.
42,
the two
12.
Paragraphs I read are paragraph 9 and paragraph 11.
42:12. Great, thank you. I want to look at that more closely. That's really interesting language.
Yeah.
But the metaphor for me that's helpful is when I think of the adjutant mind circuits, I actually think of electronic circuitry, literally. So if I think of some different mechanisms that have electronic circuitry through which electrical energy flows, right, there's let's say, a flashlight on the most primitive, very simple on-off. Then there's a radio that has more sophisticated circuitry. It can do many additional things to a flashlight with that electrical energy. And you start to have, intelligent design built into the circuitry that allows for much more sophisticated function. And then you move up, let's say, to a television, and you have now different brands of television that are in circuited different ways. And then you, let's say, look at a computer. And taking that even just a little further, a computer's got hardware, which determines its electronic transmission, but then it's got layered into it on top of the hardware software factors, which I sort of think of as akin to mindal factors. They're not physical, but they are patterning that are governing and are consistent, and they sort of stay put unless they're rearranged, and they handle information. So that to me is almost akin to the level of mind in its relation to material circuitry. And then you have a user who then willfully and with values and certain imperatives and priorities utilizes the software, that utilizes the hardware, and the whole thing functions toward purposes that the user intends that can have spiritual import. Let's say you're putting together a study group or you're in a worship aid and you have spiritual purposes and you're using a mechanism that has software that in this metaphor is mindal and using hardware that is material. And that's a helpful metaphor for me. And what it also, if I take it even a step further, human beings with intentionality design these systems and utilize the natural energies toward purposes that are superordinate, and I think what they're saying is that even on this physical level, and certainly on higher levels, on Marantia levels, like when they put together our form that encircuits the Marantia mind when we awaken on the mansion worlds, they say all kinds of beings are engaged in that process. And they also say that the higher we ascend, the more our outer forms reflect our inner nature more accurately. Kind of like the spiritual principle of Dorian Gray, picture of Dorian Gray. And I think what they're saying, yeah. And I think that ties into the supreme passages that you were talking about, Andre, is more and more as reality gets higher and higher on the scale, intentionality and spiritual value structure begins to govern the patterning of mindal and even Marantia or semi-material reality, with the aid of all these beings that inherently serve that purpose. So I just think, you know, when the quantum physicists say we came to realize that the universe is not so much a great machine as a great thought, and then took the leap to say the universe is not so much even a great thought as a great intention, intentionality or volition playing out, which I think is will is always associated, volition, purpose is always associated with personality. It doesn't really function fully without personality. So you have this ordering process, you know, where volition orders thought that then orders matter. And volition can be spiritually responsive to spiritual values, higher spiritual values of love and relationship and honor and duty and service, all those higher order things. So anyways, that metaphor is helpful for me. We as human beings order our whole material environment, including all of the mechanisms, according to our value structures. We create physical and mindful structures related to our values to serve our values. And I think that principle just unfolds at higher and higher levels as we ascend.
Yeah, I think you're right. And that comparison.
Yeah, that's a great metaphor, Marvin.
With the flashlight. With the flashlight to the radio, to the television, to the internet-connected computer. What's also going on in that evolution of technology is increased receptivity.
Uh-huh.
Which the flashlight doesn't have, but the radio has. The radio can,
right.
The circuits in the radio respond to a radio signal that's being propagated through the environment. So there's this dawning of receptivity in our technology. And even more so with television, even more so with the internet, even more so with the smartphone. You know, there's a reception capacity in the technology. And I think that's true for us as well. And that's what the life carriers are all about, is designing these life forms that have reception capacity. And there's one line here where they say in paper 65, the physical brain with its associated nervous system possesses innate capacity for response to mind ministry, just as the developing mind of a personality possesses a certain innate capacity for spirit receptivity, and therefore contains the potentials of spiritual progress and attainment.
Yeah, go ahead, finish, and there's one more thought to add, but I think that's right on target and lovely.
Yeah,
I just want to get
in the idea of receptivity and connectivity is very
much
part of our human organism, if you want to think of it as a form of technology, that our brains are somehow able to receive mind ministry. You know, we have a capacity for mind receptivity designed into our physical organism. And that just seems like, wow, so improbable.
Well,
but then you think of a smartphone, it sort of does the same thing. So,
built on the receptivity, you have the additional ability for interassociability. In other
right.
words, you know, when you mentioned, you know, moving from, let's say, my use of a computer to my use of the internet, suddenly you're interassociating with countless numbers of other functioning persons. And so the whole universe moves toward interassociation between persons, relationships really, where spiritual values can play out, and the whole supreme evolution is moving toward those higher purposes, is to rejoin the Creator in the Creator's original intentions of persons and relationships. Of love and mutual benefit. I mean, all of those higher values. So it's interesting. I mean, I think you're absolutely right, is that the mechanisms serve the mindful principles, which serve the spiritual principles and priorities. Yeah.
Yeah. There's like a layering of functionality there.
Mm-hmm.
Well, based on the conversation, you guys, I have to share this this section from this paragraph from paper 111, and you'll be more than familiar with this one. But just what we've been saying just brings it into crystal clarity somehow. It's 111.15. Mortal mind is a temporary intellect system loaned to human beings for use during a material lifetime. And as they use this mind, they are either accepting or rejecting the potential of eternal existence. Mind is about all you have of universe reality that is subject to your will. And the soul, the Mirantia self, will faithfully portray the harvest of the temporal decisions which the mortal self is making. Human consciousness rests gently upon the electrochemical mechanism below and delicately touches the spirit Mirantia energy system above. Of neither of these two systems is the human being ever completely conscious in his mortal life. Therefore must he work in mind, of which he is conscious. And it is not so much what mind comprehends as what mind desires to comprehend. There's that intention right there that ensures survival. It is not so much what mind is like as what mind is striving to be like that constitutes spirit identification. It is not so much that man is conscious of God as that man yearns for God that results in universe ascension. What you are today is not so important as what you are becoming day by day and in eternity. This quote, I think, really illustrates mind as the vehicle, you know, that allows, that carries us. And what's intriguing about that is that it's on loan, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So we get to tap into it. It is the energy, you know, and we're talking about the life carriers creating the circuitry that allows us to tap into that energy, which is the supreme, the mother spirit.
Yeah. Well, it actually becomes an arena of consciousness.
Yeah.
Yeah, they use that term in other places. They talk about the mind arena, which is fascinating in itself. Yeah.
But what I hear threaded throughout that whole passage you just read, Paula, is intentionality, is will or desire. You know, what it is we hunger for and will reach for is what governs what we become. Not in our ability, but our desire and our intention. You know, when they say that, say it's my will that your will be done to the Father, the indwelling spirit, it's not like we're capable of progressing toward paradise. We're utterly incapable in our current capacity. What is potent is our desire. And what God is saying to us is, what you will, if it's in keeping with my hopes and purposes for you, I will help you accomplish. So don't sweat your time limitations. Don't be too concerned about them. Just keep your intention steady and pure, and move forward little step by little step, and I will transform you is what God is offering.
Mm. Well, and listen to what Pam on the board says. Pam says, the adjutant's complexity into wisdom, the spirit of worship, the spirit of counsel, the spirit of knowledge, the spirit of courage, the spirit of understanding, the spirit of intuition, beginning with intuition being the so-called, quote, flashlight Marvin used. That's so true. I mean, it's interesting. It's a stair step, just as you described, you know, up to a great complexity. And the most complex being the spirit of wisdom.
You know, it's interesting about that. Also interesting about
that
comparison.
Yeah, that's great.
Yeah. Well, if you think about
that. I thought so, too.
If you think about those technologies, at some level, they become two-way. You know, in the early stages, like with television and radio, it was receptivity only. It was one-way only. We could receive it, but there was no two-way communication. But with the breakthrough into digital technology and, you know, all the thing we're familiar with, you know, we communicate both ways all the time. And if you think of the spirit of counsel, yeah, how it's positioned within the seven adjutants, in some ways it kind of represents the dawning of that capacity within ourselves as a human being, with our mind endowment, or even animals to some extent. But that spirit of counsel is like all about communication, not just receiving or pushing out, but actually engaging. So that's a fascinating sort of a correlation there in those two patterns.
And running with that metaphor, Marvin, the complexity of a computer, say, and we're accelerating, each one of those epical revelations is like a new operating system. It's an upgrade.
Yeah.
So, we're in the fifth, which would be the spirit of counsel, and we're living in the age of communication where you're right, where we don't only just receive information, we share it. We're sharing it on a scale of presence. We're all sharing, we're all communicating with each other in such an amazing way. Yeah, we're learning how to do that, but.
Yeah, and that's kind of an evolutionary breakthrough if you think about it.
Well, do we want to? This is a great discussion, you guys. And do we want to go on to life transplantation?
Yeah, let's keep reading.
Chuck, you want to continue on? Yeah.
Sure. I'm good with that. Okay, life transplantation. This is section three, paper 36. Life does not spontaneously appear in the universes. The life carriers must initiate it on the barren planets. Contemporary science is still thinking they can just make it happen somehow. Anyway, the life carriers must initiate it on the barren planets. They are the carriers, disseminators, and guardians of life as it appears on the evolutionary worlds of space. All life of the order and forms known on Urantia arises with these suns, though not all forms of planetary life are existent on Urantia. Probably just as well. The core of life carriers commissioned to plant life upon a new world usually consists of 100 senior carriers, 100 assistants, and 1,000 custodians. So earlier we were reading about these different types of life carriers. The life carriers often carry actual life plasm to a new world, but not always. They sometimes organize the life patterns after arriving on the planet of assignment in accordance with formulas previously approved for a new adventure in life establishment, was the origin of the planetary life of Urantia that it was put together here. When, in accordance with approved formulas, the physical patterns have been provided, then do the life carriers catalyze this lifeless material, imparting through their persons the vital spirit spark. And forthwith do the inert patterns become living matter. The vital spark, the mystery of life, is bestowed through the life carriers, not by them. They do indeed supervise such transactions. They formulate the life plasm itself, but it is the universe mother spirit who supplies the essential factor of the living plasm. Creative daughter of the infinite spirit comes that energy spark which enlivens the body and presages the mind. In the bestowal of life, the life carriers transmit nothing of their personal natures, not even on those spheres where new orders of life are projected. At such times, they simply initiate and transmit the spark of life, start the required revolutions of matter in accordance with the physical, chemical, and electrical specifications of the ordained plans and patterns. The life carriers are living catalytic presences which agitate, organize, and vitalize the otherwise inert elements of the material order of existence. the life carriers of a planetary core are given a certain period in which to establish life on a new world, approximately 500,000 years of the time of that planet. Half a million years, wow. At the termination of this period, indicated by certain developmental attainments of the planetary life, they cease implantation efforts. They cease implantation efforts, and they may not subsequently add anything new or supplemental to the life of that planet. That's what Andre was referring to earlier. During the ages intervening between life establishment and the emergence of human creatures of moral status, the life carriers are permitted to manipulate the life environment and otherwise favorably directionize the course of biologic evolution. And this they do, for long periods of time. When the life carriers operating on a new world have once succeeded in producing a being with will, with the power of moral decision and spiritual choice, then and there, their work terminates. They are through. They may manipulate the evolving life no further. From this point forward, the evolution of living things must proceed in accordance with the endowment of the inherent nature and tendencies which have already been imparted to and established in the planetary life formulas and patterns. The life carriers are not permitted to experiment or to interfere with will. They are not allowed to dominate or arbitrarily influence moral creatures. Moral creatures. Upon the arrival of a planetary prince, they prepare to leave, though two of the senior carriers and 12 custodians may volunteer by taking temporary renunciation vows to remain indefinitely on the planet as advisors in the matter of the further development and conservation of the life plasm. Two such sons and their 12 associates are now serving on Urantia.
What a beautiful section.
Yeah, a couple of thoughts came to mind while you were reading this, Chuck. One is that it's invariably the case, but at least in that this instance and the instance of that I'm thinking of, which is the repersonalization on the mansion worlds. It's through the agencies of the third source and center, the universe mother spirit, that life flows. I've been spending a lot of time recently just prepping some cafes and other stuff in paper 112, which is the personality survival paper. And what's really interesting is there are various roles played by the different celestial beings, our guardian angels, the thought adjuster, the archangels, in what happens to us in between the point that we cease functioning on this world and resume functioning in the reassembly chambers as persons, as living, functioning persons with functional identity. When we, as they say, the life circuits are seized by us and we regain conscious awareness and functional identity. And what they say is that it is the action of the guardian seraphim. All the elements are assembled and ready. And they say the guardian seraphim, working with a number of other celestial agencies that they don't name, reposits the soul which they are holding. They're actually holding the actual soul reality, which is in Earth and non-functioning at that point in time. It's a pattern. But it is, they say they're holding the soul. They also say that the personality records and all of the formulas of personality in down to the last detail are held by the archangels, but they don't know where the actual person is during the interim. But they do know that the soul, the slumbering soul, is in the possession of the guardian seraphim. And at that point, the guardian seraphim reposits the soul into the waiting Urantia mind mechanism, in association and commits it to the association of the thought adjuster, to liaison on with the thought adjuster, and that creates the situation where life energy can then flow into that whole arrangement, and we resume conscious functioning or identity as a person. But they say this guardian seraphim are critical in this process. It's their action that initiates the resumption of life functioning in that Mirantia form mind mechanism, which is bears some parallel relationship to the function of the life carriers. They act as a conduit, in a sense, for the life power of the mother spirit to flow through them. You know, and I think it's not coincidental that they're third source beings. So that's really interesting. The other thing that's really interesting is that these two stayed on as advisors, and we've speculated about this before, that with all of the challenges we face in the further development genetically and physiologically of the human races on this world because of the Adamic default, that, you know, at some point there may be life carriers in association with Adamic sons and daughters back here on this world, maybe even establishing an Adamic center where we're the ones that have to work with our own genetic and physiological situation. They can't directly manipulate it, but they could certainly work closely with our scientists and our leaders, you know, our social and political leaders at that far distant time, to help us recapture our momentum in that regard and move it toward its intended endpoints in the further eras of light and life. So they may play an advisory role at some points in the future, you know, that is quite central to help us in that regard. So that's interesting.
Yeah, maybe possible to kind of reconcentrate the Adamic inheritance that we have.
Yeah.
I was kind of wonder about that. But what you're saying about the, you know, putting us back together on the mansion world and how, you know, all our parts and pieces get reassembled. It seems, as you're describing all of that, to me that the soul is the living part of us that's in the custody of the seraphim. In other words, they're almost like they're pregnant or something. They're carrying this living entity from one world to another.
Which can then be
kind of built out with a new form and reconnects with mind, and the adjuster comes back and the personality returns. But there has to be a thread of continuity of life, I think, going from this planet to the mansion world. And the only entity or part of ourselves that would seem to have the capacity to provide that is our soul. So I'm just kind of getting. I've never really thought about this before, but I'm thinking that their soul is alive while it's being held by the seraphim.
What they say is actually quite.
That could be a lovely rabbit hole we could go down.
Well, they address that, they tell us actually. They say that at the point of cessation of physical function and in that interim, they say some really interesting things. They say that the soul ceases to function as a functioning identity, and they use the word seat of identity and seat of consciousness and seat of will function in very precise ways. They say in this life it's lodged in the mind. And in the next life, when we resume function, it is lodged in the soul. But they say at the point of death and during the interim period, they say some very interesting things. They say the human mortal loses identity but retains personality, but personality is inert and non-functioning. They say the adjuster loses personality and maintains identity, meaning the ongoing identity functioning is being carried along in the adjuster and provides continuity during the lapse period and until the reassembly. And when that reassembly occurs, the sense of identity is moved back from the adjuster into the soul. So I think you're right, Chuck. The sense of identity, and two things are associated with identity. One is consciousness and the other is volition or control, will function. When we're reassembled, it's lodged in the soul. But during the interim period, they say identity is continued in the thought adjuster. In other words, there's continuing consciousness and will, pre-will function in the adjuster during the interim period, and then is reassumed by the soul when the personality is once again functioning. So they're pretty mm-hmm. precise in some of the formulas they describe. It's really interesting. Mm-hmm.
I love that they keyed in on will again, and that's obviously a theme throughout the book always.
Mm-hmm.
And that, you know, when it shows up, you know, when will shows up, and I just want to share when it showed up on your ranch and what they say about that. This is from paper 62, section 7, paragraph 3, and it's a quote. To the life carriers on your ranch, greetings. We transmit assurance of great pleasure on Salvington, Edentia, and Jerusalem. In honor of the registration on the headquarters of Nebadon, of the signal of the existence on your ranch of mind of will dignity, the purposeful decision of the twins to flee northward and segregate their offspring from their inferior ancestors has been noted. This is the first decision of mind, the human type of mind, on your ranch, and automatically establishes the circuit of communication over which this initial message of acknowledgement is transmitting. So that, you know, it just reiterates again what a big deal it is when that mind of will dignity appears, and how key, what you guys were saying, in, you know, before, will, what a key role it plays, and it's a gift. From God. It's our gift from God, and it signalizes that we have reached that level where we can actually access and use that gift, use it as human beings. So important. And then they bow out. You know, they don't, again, they iterated again in this section we just read. They do not interfere with it. None of the beings in all, you know, none of the loyal beings in all of creation interfere with the prerogative of will. I just think that is such an important thing to remember, because so often we as humans do, we try to,
yeah,
you know, coerce each other and force each other and, you know, just endlessly, but they don't. What we do of our own free will is the most important thing we do. The decisions we make, those are building our soul into eternity. Go ahead, Andre.
Yeah, it's a sign of spiritual immaturity to be trying to control and coerce other human beings. It's a sign of lack of faith in the outworking of God's plan to do so. Now, there's a fine line between being persuasive and prevailing with men, quote unquote, right? Prevailing with one's fellows. But the idea of, you know, just looking at the master's life, Jesus never coerced. And all the beings in the universe, you know, all the higher beings, they are well schooled in the nature of mind, in the nature of spirit, in the nature of personality and will function. They understand that the highest prerogative of any personality is will. And they understand that the highest prerogative of will is the ability to love. And so they put a premium on that free will choice to move in that direction, because it takes reality in directions that it can't go except by personal choice. And that gets realized when you realize that the whole universe, the whole going concern of anything, did not happen except for the choice of original deity to do what he did and the way he did it. And when you begin to realize that, I mean, it takes things first of all completely away from this idea of how life, and this is how this particular section started out, right? It started out with the idea. It is not, it does not happen spontaneously. It is not an accident. It's not just coming about on its own. It's deliberate in the same way that the universe is deliberate. It's a whole different paradigm for how things happen. And therefore, they put a premium on the choices we make because they realize new things can come about that would not happen any other way except for by personality function. And that is of great value to them. And they respect that. And therefore, they not only are they proscribed from interfering, you know, they wouldn't do it anyway. They willingly take these oaths. They wouldn't. It's not like they have to. Okay, it's like you get them into a half Nelson, and now okay, life carriers, that's enough. Enough life manipulation out of you. No more. Will has come about. Obviously, they're much more mature than that. And they're taking these renunciation vows. The vows are important as a signal, not just to them, but to all levels of life, that this is the stage that has arisen on a planet. There's now will, free will function on the world, and now the world must function in that way. Well, this was the great travesty of Caligastia, Dalagastia's, and, you know, Satan and Lucifer's move. They wanted to contravene the function of human will. They really were interfering with normal evolution at that point. And that's not countenanced.
That's such a good point, Andre. And I just want to share, I know I've shared this before on the show, but this quote to me is just so invaluable, and it comes from Paper One. They established this concept of will and how important it is right up front because they really want us to understand this, and they reiterate it in so many ways throughout the papers. This is 1-2. Universal Father never imposes any form of arbitrary recognition, formal worship, or slavish service upon the intelligent will creatures of the universes. The evolutionary inhabitants of the worlds of time and space must of themselves, in their own hearts, recognize, love, and voluntarily worship him. The Creator refuses to coerce or compel the submission of the spiritual free wills of his material creatures. The affectionate dedication of the human will to the doing of the Father's will is man's choicest gift to God. In fact, such a consecration of creature will constitutes man's only possible gift of true value to the Paradise Father. In God, man lives, moves, and has his being. There is nothing which man can give to God except this choosing to abide by the Father's will. And such decisions affected by the intelligent will creatures of the universes constitutes the reality of that true worship, which is so satisfying to the love-dominated nature of the Creator Father. What being who loves God would rob him of his one true gift, right? Of the thing that gives him so much satisfaction. You know, no being loyal to God would ever seek to take that away from him, because that's what gives him satisfaction. That's what satisfies his love-dominated nature. It's the fact that you chose to come to him of your own free will. Nobody coerced you. Nobody forced you with promises of magical rewards or threats of horrible punishments. You came because it was the right thing to do, because you love God. You want to know him. And you chose to know him. You chose to find him. And that's what satisfies his love-dominated nature, your choice to find him, to know him. You know, I just love it. To me, that concept alone, humanity could, and you're right, Andre, it's because Lucifer and the Lucifer Rebellion took that away from us.
Yeah.
That very simple concept. Go ahead, Chuck.
Yeah, no, I was just agreeing with you. Yeah. I did find there's another interesting paragraph where they describe this reassembly process. And I think it's maybe worth sharing. It's kind of puts a little different light on it than the personality survival paper. I mean, it doesn't contradict it, but I think it's instructive.
Yeah, and I've got a couple others too. Go ahead, Chuck.
This one is in a place where I wouldn't expect to find it. It's in paper 30, Personalities in the Grand Universe, and I'm still trying to get a little more. I don't know, my mind around this.
One of my favorite papers.
Oh, good. That the soul is the living part of us that continues and is brought back, not brought back to life, but put back together with the elements that enable our selfhood to reemerge. But anyway, this is paragraph 15 in section 4 of paper 30. They say, the physical body of mortal flesh is not a part of the reassembly of the sleeping survivor. The physical body has returned to dust. So the life that was in our physical body is no longer, functioning. But then they say the seraphim of assignment sponsors the new body, the Marantia form, as the new life vehicle for the immortal soul and for the indwelling of the returned adjuster. The adjuster is the custodian of the spirit transcript of the mind of the sleeping survivor. So think about somebody being asleep. They're not dead. They're just asleep, right? The assigned seraphim is the keeper of the surviving identity, the immortal soul, as far as it has evolved. And when these two, the adjuster and the seraphim, reunite their personality trusts, the new individual constitutes the resurrection of the old personality, the survival of the evolving Marantia identity of the soul. But such a reassociation of soul and adjuster, and they say such a reassociation of soul and adjuster is quite properly called a resurrection, a reassembly of personality factors. But even this does not entirely explain the reappearance of the surviving personality, though you will probably never understand the fact of such an inexplicable transaction. You will sometime experientially know the truth of it if you do not reject the plan of mortal survival. So I'm just noting words like immortal soul.
Yeah,
implying
very
interesting. That it's alive in some sense, and that the seraphim are charged with holding this living but sleeping entity. I don't know if that'd be the right way to describe it. But
well, they
describe it
describe it in 112 as the forms and formulas of personality that are these once active and now inert. So I don't think it's a living reality. It is all the patterning and all of the details and elements, but it isn't a state of stasis. It's not functioning with consciousness or volition, which is sort of associated with identity. That passage is really interesting. Let me share a couple of others and then because I think all of these passages kind of reflect on the subject which we're we're going around with and enjoying.
If I can just briefly referee this, I would say you both have scored points for your contentions, but the jury is still out.
Yeah, I agree.
Could this
agree.
Be both? Could this
so,
be both
so
living and inert?
So
something alive.
Here,
Anyway, go ahead.
So here's a few other passages. This is 112:3-7. Upon death, the thought adjuster temporarily loses personality, but not identity. The human subject temporarily loses identity, but not personality. On the mansion worlds, both reunite in eternal manifestation. And then there's the rest of that paragraph really relates to whether human beings come back to connect with people on this life, which is not relevant to what we're talking about. And then a little later on, they say, "112:5-4, human beings possess identity only in the material sense. Such qualities of the self are expressed by the material mind as it functions in the energy system of the intellect. When it is said that man has identity, it is recognized that he is in possession of a mind circuit which has been placed in subordination to the acts and choosing of the will of the human personality. But this is a material and purely temporary manifestation, just as the human embryo is a transient parasitic stage of human life. Human beings from a cosmic perspective are born, live, and die in a relative instant of time. They are not enduring, but mortal personality through its own choosing possesses the power of transferring its seat of identity from the passing material intellect system to the higher Marantra soul system, which in association with a thought adjuster is created as a new vehicle for personality manifestation. Then the next two paragraphs are really interesting. 112:5-18, and this is just as a result of a search on adjuster and identity and personality. 112:5-18 and 112:6-8. The return of the adjuster to the waiting Marantra creature, that's the third factor. The adjuster is the eternal custodian of your ascending identity. Your monitor is the absolute assurance that you yourself and not another will occupy the Marantra form created for your personality awakening. And the adjuster will be present at your personality reassembly to take up once more the role of paradise guide to your surviving self. The persistence of memory is proof of the return of the identity of original selfhood. It is essential to complete reconsciousness of personality continuity and expansion. Those mortals who ascend without adjusters are dependent on the instruction of seraphic associates for the reconstruction of human memory. Otherwise, the Marantra souls of the spirit-fused mortals are not limited. The pattern of memory persists in the soul, but this pattern requires the presence of the former adjuster to become immediately self-realizing as continuing memory. Without the adjuster, it requires considerable time for the mortal survivor to re-explore and relearn to recapture the memory consciousness of the meanings and values of the former existence. There's one other paragraph that I haven't found that really relates to this, and I'll try and find it. What I take away from this is that there is continuing identity, meaning continuing consciousness. There's no lapse of consciousness in the adjuster. The mortal being has a lapse of conscious functioning or awareness and will functioning. And the soul is, and I'll find the paragraph, the soul is in a state of latent stasis. It's not actually functioning when it's in the possession of the guardian seraphim. Mm-hmm. It's not actually alive or conscious or volitional in any sense. It's
Well, I don't know about the alive part, but it's not functioning. You know, but they refer to them as sleeping survivors. So maybe the soul is more properly thought of as being asleep. Here's just one line from paper 16. They say, the survival of identity is dependent on the survival of the immortal soul of Naranta status and increasingly divine value. Personality identity survives in and by the survival of the soul. So I don't know if those contradict what you were reading, but if that contradicts what you're reading, or maybe it's just shining a different light on it. But there's, you know, our patterns of behavior, our moral choices and all of that, that's all recorded in our soul, as I understand it. While the adjuster, it has this transcript of our spiritual nature.
So here's the paragraph I was thinking of. Sorry, bear with
yeah,
me.
Yeah,
it's 112.35. And it says, after death, the material body returns to the elemental world from which it was derived, but two non-material factors of surviving personality persist. The pre-existent adjuster with a memory transcription of the mortal career proceeds to Divinington, and there also remains in the custody of the destiny guardian the immortal Marantia soul of the deceased human. And here's the sentence that to me is pretty interesting. I don't know if it's definitive as you're thinking, Andre, but it's at least informative. These phases and forms of soul, these once kinetic but now static formulas of identity. And that's to me the essential wording. These phases and forms of soul, these once kinetic but now static formulas of identity, are essential to repersonalization on the Marantia worlds, and it is the reunion of the adjuster and the soul that reassembles the surviving personality that reconsciousizes you at the time of the Marantia awakening. So my reading of that is that it's the adjuster that maintains consciousness and functional identity. When that is reassociated with these once kinetic but static formulas of identity which are in the soul, then everything functions together as a whole again, as a functioning person.
Yeah. But static doesn't necessarily mean it's lifeless. It just means it's not functioning
I'm in agreement with that. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, static is the way that the I am, the theoretical I am, is described at the beginning before differentiating, you know, into things. So if that's static, well, then there's something very alive in that kind of static nature. And one of those contravenes that it certainly speaks to the idea of, you know, kinetic and functional and all of these things, active. You can say all of those things, but in the same way that you can have a virus that is static, even for, you know, science is telling us potentially hundreds of years, and then, quote unquote, come alive by finding the right host, well, that's indicative at the highest and the lowest levels that static does not mean unalive.
Yeah, so I'm
yeah,
I'm
trying to just posit the idea here that the thought adjuster is the inceptor of the soul. The soul is something other than a strictly Marantia reality in the sense that, you know, they describe Marantia reality in some ways as an artificial reality that bridges between matter and spirit, but is very, very important and is a part of the whole, you know, functional ascension regime. And yet, the soul is incepted by the thought adjuster, which we need to remind ourselves is God himself. In fact, God as practically I am. you know, this pre-differentiated fragment of God that is before energy and before spirit. And so what would God be making in the soul? It would seem to me it would be something very much alive.
Well, they refer to the soul in another place as the embryo of the future Marantia vehicle of personality identity. And what I'm trying to get to here, going back to the paper we're reading, you know, we're learning that the life carriers impart life. I mean, with the mother spirit, they create life, you know, and our physical body is a result of that effort on the part of the life carriers. So because of the life carriers and the spark from the mother spirit and everything that's gone into the design of our organism, we can have the experience of being alive, right, on this planet. And we continue to be alive on the mansion worlds. And somehow or other, life that was originally given by the mother spirit into our physical bodies somehow carries over, continues to be alive, even though our physical body falls away, kind of like a booster rocket or something, and we no longer have our living physical body because it's died. But something else that has been created that's new, that's also alive, which I think is our soul, the way they describe it. And that's what gives us the potential for, you know, being put back together in the mansion world, getting off the planet and surviving this life, is the evolution of a non-physical version of ourselves. And that version of ourselves also has to be alive. And I'm just sort of pondering the idea that initial spark from the mother spirit of life that we enjoy so much, or most of the time, has continuity beyond the physical. So I don't know if they talk anywhere about that, but that's sort of the impression I'm getting, that the life that's in us now does endure, but not in a physical organism. So it's like cowboy movie.
I think
where you had to go from that, you change horses. You know, you're on one horse and there's a horse riding beside you, and you change over to the other one. Right?
I think our language is lacking enough specificity to speak intelligently about what's going on here. So for instance, if we're speaking about the soul, you know, the different parts of the human personality, you've got a body. Right, which obviously the body dies and returns to dust, so it's no longer functioning, and a new Marantia form, the equivalent of body, is provided on the mansion worlds for reassembly. The mind circuitry, which is associated with the material body here, is no longer functioning, so there is not a vehicle for consciousness and volitional functioning, because there's no mind circuitry, and consciousness and volition can't function without mind in some fashion, and mind is provided, a new mind circuitry with a new Marantia form is provided on the mansion worlds, and so consciousness and volitional function can resume once the whole reassembly is completed. I agree with you 100%, Chuck, that the soul is certainly not in any sense dead, right?
Uh-huh.
But I would also say, with trying to use precise language, that the soul in the interim is not functioning, and it does not have conscious awareness, and it does not have volitional or willful functioning occurring, because it is not in association with a living energy system. The living energy system is the
Marantia. Except for the seraphim.
Well, the seraphim are holding. Yeah, and what they're saying they're holding is these once kinetic but now static formulas of identity. So it's not dead.
The embryo, but they refer to it as an embryo.
Correct. So I think our language is imprecise, because partially I think our language is associated with material or biological realities. That's the metaphor we think of when we think of life. I think the soul is definitely alive. But I think it is also not functioning, it is not conscious, and it has no volitional function in that interim. It's in a state of stasis, or non-functioning. Mm-hmm. And the continuity of experience, functioning, and volition are carried with the adjuster, is what they're saying. And when that continuous functioning consciousness and volition are reassociated with the static, once kinetic but now static formulas of identity that are in the soul resumes its role as the functioning seat of identity. Its memory is then continuously reassociated with through the adjuster, and that soul is now both alive and functioning. So I think we're parsing terms. I would agree with you. I think the soul is certainly, it's not that it doesn't exist or it's dead. It's that it's in a state of, they use different words, slumber. Stasis, mm-hmm. for me is a good term. So it is alive, but it's mm-hmm. non-functioning in any sense until it resumes functioning with the reassociation with the adjuster in a personality, in a Marantia and mind form that allows for energy flow to occur in that mm-hmm. being. Otherwise, mm-hmm. energy is not unfolding in any sense. It's inert. So I think, you know, I think this is a good conversation.
Well, Paula, I think we have full agreement, don't we? Do you hear full agreement between both parties?
I want to share some of the things that are being said on the board because they're pretty good. I mean, they always are, and we don't always have time to share them. But I want to share what Pam said. She said identity survives because of the soul, because the soul is the God content we have accumulated. I loved that, Pam. That was great. And then Perry said, search is a breath mint. Search is a candy mint. Stop. You're both right. That was great.
Right. We have a certain generation. Some of us remember that commercial on Canadian television, which was ubiquitous.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Ubiquitous for more than a decade.
Oh, okay.
Yeah,
and John asked the question, and it must be something we said along the way. He said, what does the theoretical I am mean? So I said,
oh my God.
You know.
Oh my God. It's 25 words.
Yeah. But if you want to take a stab at that one, I'll go on mute again.
It's
yeah,
another
I think we need another 2 hours on that one.
Yeah.
Yeah, but I think just to summarize for me, Chuck, I think some of the comments, you know, the search is a breath mint, search is a candy mint, I love that because I used to wake up for years with that phrase in my mind because it was so ubiquitous, a commercial. But I think I really do think our language is imprecise. I mean, I think the soul is both
alive.
Well,
we're working on it.
Yeah,
that's
yeah.
Why we're
the
talking,
soul is both
yeah.
both alive, and it's not functioning in many senses the way it functions here or there. So, you know, I mean, it's I think the reality is more subtle than what our language can zero in on and define precisely at this point.
Mm-hmm.
So I think we're talking facets. Yeah. Of the reality.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, wonderful.
Well, I'm trying to get a sense of the continuity of life that was originally established by the life carriers for each of us,
uh-huh.
and how our life, the continuity of that life that we have now, is enabled and maintained going into the next life. That something has to remain alive to make that bridge from one form to the next. And I think we're in agreement on that.
Yeah, there's one
wonderful
passage that would be worth finding. It's the one where they describe life as being inseparable from an energy system with functional capacities. I'll go looking for it, but it's also relevant
mm-hmm.
to what we're talking about. You might be able to find it quicker than me or Andre. I think we probably all know the one we're speaking about. But that's also pertinent to what we're talking about.
You know, and I want to point mm-hmm. out, too, that through this with the life carriers, you know, the value of this conversation about the soul is obviously that this is what they're laboring to create. This is what their labors create. Their labors, all of
mm-hmm.
them, millions of years on a planet. all that they do, create the soul. And the soul is the vehicle of ongoing life, eternity. The soul is the eternal for all of us. And this is what they're trying to create. This is what they're working on. The first step
and
is mind, will, dignity. Is because we are partnering with God in this creation of this eternal, you know, this embryo that becomes spirit. And this is what they're laboring for. All of what they do is for this, to create a soul. All of the souls. Mm-hmm. It's like Jesus.
Well,
I hear Jesus saying,
Yeah.
I hear the midwayers telling us that Jesus viewed our world as a veil of soul making. Not a veil of tears.
Mm-hmm.
A veil of soul making. Which is really what all worlds are, right? That's what they're for. They're the grand nurseries of the universe. You know,
mm-hmm.
where we germinate. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
So
here's another just quick line here that reinforces what you're saying, I think. They say the human soul personality, this is in paper 132, of man, survives mortal death by identity association with the indwelling spark of divinity, which would be the adjuster, which is immortal, and which functions to perpetuate the human personality upon a continuing and higher level of progressive universe existence. The concealed seed of the human soul is an immortal. I love that. You know, it's like you're saying, you know, all of this effort has been put into creating the conditions for us to have the opportunity to grow a soul. And if we succeed, then that can be carried over into the next life. But within that, you know, there's this idea of it's really the adjuster that provides the immortality. It's our association, rather, with the adjuster that gives us the potential for immortality.
Mm-hmm.
And reawakens our association with the adjuster, which then carries that forward.
Yeah.
The concealed seed of the human soul is an immortal spirit. That's so poetic.
Mm. Love it.
I want to point out in paragraph 2 this idea. This has always intrigued me because for the life of me, I cannot figure out how the life carriers often actually carry life plasm to a new world. You know, that in fact, you know, they didn't do it here. They formulated it here. Well, that I get. That, in fact, all of science gets, whether they think it happened spontaneously or whether, you know, you come to a belief that it had to have been formulated here. But the idea of bringing life through space as a life carrier, my question is, how are they coming to the world, and what facility, you know, either within themselves or without themselves, are they using to actually, quote unquote, carry actual life plasm to a new world? That's fascinating.
Good question.
You know, it's physical life. It's not.
Uh-huh.
They're talking about life plasm, or they wouldn't have stated it that way. They mean physical life. So, any thoughts on that? Do they have a pouch?
They must have a heck of a pouch. Yeah, got a refrigerated. I don't know. Who knows? But how they would get that through space without it, like, burning up or something, I don't know. They must obviously have a method for doing it.
Radiation, the whole deal. I mean, it has to be protected from you know, solar radiation, all of that kind of stuff as they get close to their new star of the planet that they're
light on that. When they talk about the Adam and Eve children, you know, the ones that decided to leave the planet, say in order to transport them, they lost their reproductive capability as a result.
Right.
and they became wards of the Most Highs or something, which is also very unusual because, like, you know, material sons and daughters aren't normally on that world.
Well,
the idea of them being taken off the planet, which is very unusual, requires...
You know what occurs to me? That statement where they say the Melchizedeks and the life carriers can dematerialize life and transport it somewhere else. So it must be a power. It must be some functionality they have. But Pam on the board also said, do they only carry the life plasm patterns? Because only the mother spirit makes that plasm come alive. And that's an interesting point, too. They carry the patterns, and then she makes it come alive.
Sure. But even so, they're carrying, you know, the physical pattern, the actual physical stuff. So it is the DNA. It is the, you know, all the material, chemical arrangement, whatever makes up that particular life pattern. It is both physical equipment of it and all the capability within that physical equipment of being energized by life. So that really does raise the question, how do they get it here if they're actually bringing life plasm? Because, again, it's easier to understand formulating it here, frankly. It's easier to understand how they could do that.
Yeah.
Why there's any kind of advantage, or why they would do that in the first place, even if it was experimental. What about it being an experimental world means that they should or they formulate the life here? Why is that important? Because experimental formulated somewhere else or formulated here.
Right.
Don't know what that is. Any thoughts?
I don't know. You know, what occurred to me when we were reading that section is, what happens if mind of will dignity doesn't appear? You know, what do they do then?
Yeah. Well, I wonder how often that fails.
Is it a given?
Because
yeah.
I wonder. I mean, it's certainly not a given that it doesn't take certain forms. It's not a given that all of it survives from generation to generation. They say that there are strains of human life that have been forever lost to the world that will, you know, maybe never be recouped recombinantly, you know, through life evolution. Some remarkable strains. And so when you think about that, you realize what they mean is there are certain kinds of human beings we've never seen, made advantage to our world, but they're gone now. And you can only wonder at that. You never really understand what you're missing, in the same way that we really don't know what we're missing by having the broadcasts. We can't even begin to imagine. We can begin to imagine. Can't truly imagine having connection with our fellow human beings on other worlds as a growing civilization. We don't understand that. Yeah, and so it's fascinating what they put out here and get us to think about.
Right. I noticed that, Andre, I noticed that Vaughn has his hand up on the board, and we're almost out of time, and I'd like to give him a chance to say what
Absolutely.
He has to say. I put it up earlier, too.
I was falling down on the job with my on the board. So,
hi, Vaughn.
Vaughn, how are you? Do you have a quick question? Because we're down to our last 3 minutes.
Yeah. In the early times of the Urantia movement, we had all these hippies talking about spirit personalities and everything. that would be something that in 100 years or decades in the future will be reintegrating into our conversations. We cover so very, very much in our internet study groups. It's like we need to take weeks and weeks to talk about these topics sometimes. And then the second thing more recently I wanted to share about how Jim McNally was up on the stage there in the early days with a friend, and they explained about bringing life to the planet. And at the grocery store, he had bought a yellow cardboard box that had the wax paper cereal inside of it, and it was called Life.
Life cereal, right? Exactly. Yeah, he was good at having a humorous
brand
on everything.
Cereal. Right. Remember?
Yeah,
that.
Yeah. The old. Yeah. I remember Life cereal.
Yeah,
as well.
He brought the
great.
Box of Life cereal. He was the life carrier.
Well.
Yeah.
Sounds like y'all remember that particular thing. He was there with his friend.
I'm sure we have.
He was there with his friend, and he was having a fit because the friend had forgot to bring the lice, but he had backed up with his own box.
That sounds like the early days of your ranch skit.
Let's get Mikey.
I think I might have even seen that skit.
Yeah.
God bless you.
Thanks for that.
Well, very good.
There's one detail that pertains to your question, Andre, that I don't think is made clear, which is whether or not that plasm has been active before it's transported.
Well, I'm thinking that it
to the
hasn't.
Planet Earth. That
I'm
happens
thinking
after.
That it hasn't. Yeah.
Yeah, that's kind of
but
what I'm
thinking.
Can you
imagine
too.
If it had been activated and they were transporting it, and now it starts dividing while they're taking it? I don't think that would be wise.
Tendrils
reaching
out of the box at the – yeah. Yeah.
Right.
So that might be part of it.
But I agree with you. You know, here's that those words again, static, potentials, you know, inert, but formulated life, and yet requiring the divine spark, as was pointed out on the board, that, you know, it's only after that divine spark comes after it's plugged in to the life circuits that, bingo, we have a going concern.
Exactly,
you know.
Yeah. And
yeah,
they admit that
there
they don't
go.
Really understand that. They don't really understand that.
Yeah.
In paper 36.
Well, friends, we're out of time for the day.
Seconds.
I hate to say it, but it's such a great conversation. But we'll be back next week. And we'll be talking about Section 4, Melchizedek Life Carriers. Hope you guys can join us. Thanks to all of you on the board. It was a wonderful conversation. Thanks for bearing with me as I have to mute and unmute, but it's great. I'll be back at my desk next week. So it's great to be here with Gary and his family. They're so wonderful. We'll see Andre later today. Yay!
So we're continuing
in about 3 hours.
Continuing with the life carrier paper next week?
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah, we'll be on the Melchizedek life carriers, In the Midsonite worlds. Won't that be fun?
Yep. Section 4.
Yeah.
Oh, boy, oh, boy.
All right. I'll look forward to that.
Well, thanks, friends. Love you.
Love you all.
Thank you for being here, everyone, and thank you for listening. And good to be with you, Chuck and Marvin, and...
Uh-huh.
See you in about actually 4 or 5 hours. Yeah.
looking
Alrighty.
Forward to it, guys.
Yeah, have a great week.
All right, be well.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
You've been listening to The Cosmic Citizen, a radio program focused primarily on the study and discussion of the Urantia Book and its teachings. The Urantia Book is a religious text that claims to be written by angels and other superhuman personalities. If you are a Urantia Book reader or a spiritual seeker looking for new truth, we hope and pray you have been nourished and edified by our ministry. Please remember that the views expressed on this program do not reflect the official views and opinions of any Urantia organizations. There is no official interpretation of the Urantia Book. So all opinions expressed on this program exclusively reflect the personal biases of the hosts, guests, and callers who participate in these discussions. And remember, only a brave person is willing honestly to admit and fearlessly to face what a sincere and logical mind discovers.